folks said they don't fear death, but rather they're worried about possible pain and incapacitation. And there's a recent and growing discussion about extreme medical interventions for people who are very old or at the end of their life. And what is the cost of these in terms of pain and expense of these so-called heroic measures? And is there anything we can do to prepare for death? What are the formal and legal preparations we can make? Tonight, I'll be interviewing Julie DeLong, a board member of Juno's Foundation for the End of Life Care, and recently director, she's retired now, but director of social services at Wildflower Court. Julie has been a social worker at Juno Hospice and Home Care and has worked in the field of aging for over 30 years. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter, Julie.
Thank you, Elaine. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, great. Julie, I'd just like to begin, because it's so useful to people, with simply the basics of what a person can accomplish in addition to their will before the end of their life to maybe ensure that their dying process more reflects their wishes.
Well, the most important thing a person can do, first of all, is having discussions with the people that you love and care about, your family, your physician, and then completing on paper the documents that they can have in hand to express those wishes. The first one, there's a form called the Power of Attorney, for the state of Alaska. That one is a general form where one can give another person the authority to make any kind of business, financial, real estate, catch all. They could include healthcare matters in the event that the person's not able to make those decisions themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The other document called Advanced Directives for Alaska, it's Advanced Directives for Healthcare and Mental Health Care. That one, you can appoint a power of attorney for healthcare wishes,
separate.
For your healthcare wishes.
Separate from your executor and your will, separate from your mm-hmm. power of attorney.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oftentimes, especially if there are several family members, one might be appointed to take care of healthcare issues. Another one might be appointed to take care of financial issues, depending on that person's strength or just personal preference.
Yeah. Yeah. And is this what some people call living will, the advanced directives?
Exactly. It started out as living will, and it was kind of short and sweet, one page. The ones developed by the state of Alaska and adopted by the state of Alaska is much more comprehensive so that a person can make detailed decisions about do they want CPR, do they want artificial means of breathing or feeding. If there's mental health issues and they can't say what they want, do they want to have any kind of psychiatric treatment? I mean, it's very detailed so that the person can make known what he or she wants in the event that they cannot speak up for themselves.
What's the chance of these advanced directives being ignored? It's, as I understand it, it's not 100% guarantee that you'll get what you want. Is there a chance the doctor could simply ignore it and not go by it? Let's say, even if your appointed person is there, does the doctor have the ultimate say?
The doctor does not have the ultimate say, although they might have an opinion, especially if providing a certain mode of treatment might help the person maybe temporarily. Maybe it isn't a life or death situation. They might make a recommendation. Also, on the family side, people panic. Patient panics, the daughter panics, the spouse panics, and all of a sudden they want all the treatment that they can get. So it really goes both ways between what the physician might recommend and what the family might suddenly want.
And obviously, this person who is your designated representative for your living will only comes into play if you are incapacitated.
Exactly.
So as long as you are cogent, you make your own decisions for yourself. But if you were comatose or unable to respond at all, you're really depending on this particular appointed person to follow your wishes. And I think that's why it's real important to have the conversation, not just have a document that they see for the first time.
Exactly. So that you have a person that you trust and feel like will be there to, advocate for what you want. You know, and sometimes a person can succumb to pressure by nursing staff, social work staff, physician staff as to, a course of treatment, even if the person specifically said, I don't want this. The family member that's the advocate might, should we change our mind here, based on the information they're given. You'd want somebody strong to say, nope, this is what Dad wanted.
Well, we're going to get into this a little later in the program where both of us, Julie and I, were influenced by Atul Gawande's book, very important work called Being Mortal. And Atul Gawande is both a surgeon and a professor at Harvard who writes about medical ethic issues. And I think his book is right now the seminal book to read on what we're talking about tonight on the radio show. So what we're going to do is get to that later when we talk about heroic measures, so-called heroic measures. Okay. So you've got that document. So where does that document go? What do you do with it? Do you put it in your drawer?
Well, keep it in your file. Some people keep it under lock and key. You want to be sure that your physician is aware of your choices and that if there's a copy of it in your file at the physician's office. Whoever is the appointed power of attorney absolutely needs to have a copy, or maybe there's two or three powers of attorney. Each one of those individuals needs to have a copy of the advance directive, as well as the person having a copy. You can't predict when you might suddenly go to the hospital, but if you know you're going, grab that copy and bring it with you so you can hand it to the emergency room doctor.
I think the difficult thing for ourselves, if we're the patient, or for relatives, is to really determine when is somebody actually terminal. And that's what heroic measures are about, or so-called heroic measures, which is, well, maybe this intervention will bring them back to life. But what Gawande has many, many examples of where quality of life diminished and may or may not have added a few days or months to the person's life, but their suffering greatly increased and made it much more difficult for them to be with, to be really able to connect with their family members, what they think is most important. But again, we're going to get to that a little bit later. The Foundation for End-of-Life Care has published a manual or a book, and it's called When You're Not Here. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. As part of our mission to educate and provide as much information as possible to help people make decisions for themselves, the book was put together with several individuals in the community, with hospice staff, with staff at the hospital, with board members. It was quite a collaboration, and the book was meant to, as a guide, to share with family, start that planning, talk about your wishes, let your family know what you're thinking. What do you do for attorneys? How about estate planning? Even talking about what funeral arrangements. Many of these conversations are not ones that people have ahead of time, until the very end. It also has several resources in the back of the book. Talks about different aids or, for the family after the death of a person. It talks about grief and grieving and, what a person might expect. It provides a lot of support and points to resources in the community that a person could turn to, not just here in Juneau, but maybe the same types of agencies, in any state across the country.
I think it's amazing that this book came out in June. I've gone through it. Not only have I gone through it, I filled it out. And, oh, yeah, I try to practice what I preach. And having Julie on my show before and Van Sanders and being a hospice volunteer, it hits me definitely between the eyes that I've got to walk my talk and get it done, because it would be like the shoemaker's children who have holes in their shoes because we don't do what we talk about. It's a wonderful book, and where can you get it?
It's sold locally at Hearthside Books, but also at different events that Foundation for End of Life Care has. We also like to hand them out to individuals who attend events.
Do you have any events coming up?
This coming October 3rd at the health fair out at Nugget Mall.
Oh.
We're planning on sharing a booth. I still have to fill out the form, but we're planning on sharing a table with hospice and home care so that people could come and ask any questions. We'll have, I'll have copies of the forms, powers of attorney, advanced directives, and copies of our book.
Oh, super.
So people could ask about hospice care. People could ask about advanced care planning.
And do you have any speakers coming? Because you've had wonderful, incredible speakers in the past.
We have. We were thrilled to most recently have Dr. Linda Smith, a palliative care doctor, physician, come down from Providence. Mm-hmm. And her palliative care social worker, Deanna Seropian. They were wonderful. They gave a community presentation as well as a professional presentation so that doctors, nurses, and social workers were also able to earn continuing ed credits.
And I was there for the professional presentation. It was top-notch. Even though I think I know about palliative care, I didn't know as much as I knew after I walked out of the presentation, when I walked in, that is. I learned a whole lot, and I was very heartened to see my own physician in attendance, because if she's still around when I am in the dying process, I really want somebody to understand palliative care. Let's just briefly mention, could you explain what palliative care is?
Yes. Palliative care is a medical specialty that helps patients and their families, live fully as long as possible when faced with a life-threatening or very serious illness. It looks at the whole person, addressing physical, social, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual needs. It facilitates patient autonomy and access to information and choices, provides management of pain and management of the side effects that may develop during the course of an illness or the treatment of it. It can be provided at any time during a serious illness. People often wonder what's the difference between palliative care and hospice care.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hospice is palliative care for people who likely have 6 months or less to live. Hospice care is always palliative, but not all palliative care is hospice.
As hospice care. Mm-hmm. But now, if you were, you wouldn't have palliative care if you had an illness they thought you could recover from. Is that correct?
Yes, you could. I mean, that's the difference.
Huh.
Palliative care is associated with any kind of a very serious illness or life-threatening, where one is still the physician, a team, often nurses, social workers, in conjunction with the patient and the family, are looking at meeting their whole person, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, as well as addressing treatment for the person.
I thought that part of palliative care, maybe I didn't get everything out of this workshop, but I thought part of palliative care was the person has a condition, but the medical treatment they are getting is not meant to cure them. So it wouldn't be a radical intervention meant to cure them. It would be to make them more comfortable.
It depends on if that person is determined to have 6 months or less to live. That's, again, the difference between hospice and palliative care. A person can still receive palliative care while they're also getting curing treatment.
Oh, okay. Have you noticed Julie, some of the comments that Jimmy Carter has made when he was diagnosed with the terrible prognosis that he's not going to live very long from cancer. Did you note?
Well, I was struck by, you know, him saying that he's, you know, lived a good life and that he's ready to go if God is ready to take him. And I think oftentimes, you know, for a person feeling maybe more comfortable with, you know, towards the end of their life, it's that life review and maybe looking at all that he has done and accomplished. He's done, of course, you know, quite a bit worldwide, you know. But if he did have a valid comment when he said he's not sure how his wife is going to feel about him.
Yeah, well, he was pretty
being
funny.
Ready to go.
Because I listened to a news blip, and he said he was ready to go, but then he chuckled and said, well, maybe Roseanne isn't ready for that quite yet. But I was really struck at what a role model he is. He has been one of our, if not the greatest, former presidents in terms of humanitarian service. He's an amazing, amazing person, and he is keeping that up until the day he dies. He even mentioned palliative care. He said he is undergoing palliative care. And I think he said radiation. And that, I learned, you know, real important that you can be getting radiation or even chemotherapy in order to lessen your symptoms and have you more pain-free, but there's no expectation that it'll cure you. That's what it happened to a friend of mine. That those treatments, though they look like they're meant to cure, they are actually meant to give you more comfort. Yeah.
A better quality of life.
And better quality of life. Let's switch over to looking at elder care. And you worked at Wildflower Court for how many years?
12. Well, initially, St. Anne's Care Center.
Oh, you were there?
Before they moved over to the new building by the hospital and then changed names to Wildflower Court.
Right. And you were head of social services?
Yeah.
So this has been something that you have spent, and you were at hospice before. So you have spent so many years working with elderly, with people who are very, very ill, and people who are dying. So given all that, and perhaps being somewhat inspired by Gawande's book. The first half of this book we're talking about is on facilities for aging, and he is talking about new visions and new models. So tell me a little bit about what's new from our horrible stereotype of nursing homes.
Well, you know, just to back up a little bit, and, you know, initially when I was reading, you know, because the book just came out last year, and when he's initially talking about his perception of nursing homes, I'm inside thinking, wait a minute, it's changed. It's not as awful as you're depicting it in your book. But it's definitely the way it was, you know, very medical model, treatment-oriented, safety-oriented, institutionalized, rigid.
And he said more for the convenience of the staff than how what works with the patients. Like he gave one example of a cart with food on it that gets rolled down the aisle, especially in dementia units where people can kind of eat when they want to. Because if you regiment eating for some dementia patients, it doesn't work. Yeah, little snack carts.
Yeah, and it was very much where the individuals living in a facility were on the facility schedule, as opposed to the facility adopting to whatever the person's individualized or personalized schedule was. And so he spent quite a bit of time talking about people, it's true, being strapped in wheelchairs for safety, you know, for those people that, you know, they were afraid might fall, and if you break a bone, you know, we all know everything goes downhill from there if someone falls and breaks something. But then he was especially pleased and encouraged by some individuals that he met. You know, one woman who had started an assisted living in Oregon that was trying to keep people home as long as possible in their own homes or their own apartments and providing individualized care. But then especially he was impressed by Bill Thomas, who is the founder of the Eden Alternative, movement in the United States, and I think it's actually spread worldwide now. But that was back in 1991. He became the medical director of a nursing facility back in the East Coast. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it right now. But, you know, walking into the facility, he just was struck by how awful it was with Bill Thomas was. And he coined the three plagues of nursing home, which was boredom, loneliness, and helplessness.
Uh-huh.
And he was determined to do something about it. So he worked with the administrator and wanted to start bringing life and home into the facility so mm-hmm. that people were engaged and treatment was more individualized and they felt like they could do what they wanted and were living the way they wanted to live. So he's coined bringing in plants for people had plants to take care of, their birds, dogs, cats.
Wow, which is plants, piece of cake.
Uh-huh.
Dogs?
Yeah, a challenge. I mean, and that's what he talks about. It was a challenge to, you know, for staff also to learn, no, I'm not just here for nursing anymore. I'm here to help make this person's life better in the way they want it, which might involve helping take care of pets, meaning feeding, cleaning up after.
Wow.
You know, and the individuals thrived with suddenly having purpose, responsibility, feeling like they weren't, you know, and it took time. This didn't happen overnight. But gradually being able to feel they had a life worth living. That was a book that Bill Thomas wrote, A Life Worth Living. And from there, you know, it spread, and I believe both the Juneau Pioneer Home and Wildflower Corps, it was St. Anne's Care Center at the time. I remember because it was when I started at St. Anne's Care Center back in 1999. They were both very excited about getting their certification as an Eden Alternative facility and then working hard as a staff and making changes as time went on with residents and family members to make each life worth living for the individuals.
Tell me, at the Pioneer Home and Wildflower mm-hmm. Court, what is there that is part of the Eden Alternative model? What would I see if
well,
I walk in?
You know, initially plants, you see. Pets, the Pioneer Home
really
has cats. The Wildflower Court started out having cats and birds, well, and fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe they ever had dogs because part of it was the logistics of who will actually be responsible. It's for the dogs, especially as a person might not be able to provide the care. Although, a few years ago, one of the residents wanted to bring his dog in. Right now, you know, friends had been taking care of it. We had a home meeting for all the people that lived in his home to discuss bringing in the dog. How did people feel? Was anybody allergic? The community of that home decided, yes, they all wanted the dog to come in because the dog brought quite a bit of joy to, you know, everyone else. That resident was able to take care of the dog, you know, get it outside. And then when the resident couldn't, there were friends that would come and, you know, pick up the dog.
Aww.
So that was a dog that was at Wildflower
and
Court.
So the mm-hmm. facility doesn't
yeah.
provide the dog.
No, staff, though. Staff will bring in their dogs and then and pass out biscuits and bones and treats to residents in particular that liked the dogs and wanted to. Now, you know, really, not everybody likes dogs and not everybody likes cats. So, you know, so then that's where it was individualized. Okay, this resident wants to be sure that he has a treat to feed the dog when the staff person brings the dog in. And so that was facilitated and even, you know, encouraged for
pretty
the person.
Pretty fat dogs. So they're getting treats from everybody.
Well,
so are there any cats? Are there any resident cats at either facility?
The Pioneer Home has at least a couple cats. I don't know
cool.
for sure how many. And Wildflower Court used to. But then as it became such that, you know, the resident who brought the cat in couldn't take care of it, it pretty soon staff ended up taking care of the cat because then one of the other residents was trying to run it over with his wheelchair. I mean, not everybody likes cats. So we had to start thinking about the cat's welfare. And then, so staff were taking care of the cat up in administration and then bringing the cat out to the residents that enjoyed cats.
What about birds?
At least one bird right now. I know the Pioneer Helm has birds, and I know Wildflower Court has at least one bird that different residents who especially enjoy the bird will maybe have it for the weekend or have it for an overnight in their room, and they kind of share the bird. You know, the cage can wheel around.
Okay, so flowers and occasional animals. Anything else that differentiates it?
Well, getting away from that rigidity of the institutions. You know, people can get up what they want. They have care meetings with family, residents, and staff, focused on what does the person who lives there want. You know,
so nobody comes in at 7 a.m. and wakes all the residents up.
It depends on that. They might if their physician has scheduled medications. At a certain time, for the person taken. But the person would have the choice of saying, I don't want to take that medication right now.
Or going back to sleep.
And I know they're working on more food choices throughout the day. You know, not everybody wants a big hot breakfast. They might just want toast. So a person could, somebody who gets up at 6, staff would help them with coffee or tea or toast. And until maybe a hot breakfast might come a little bit later, or a person didn't want to eat, well, then that's okay. We'll heat it up again later for you.
Oh.
And so there's definitely more individualization with what a person's personal preferences are.
One thing that I think is very special about both places, Wildflower Court and the Pioneer's Home, is that Juno really dotes on both places. Mm-hmm. And singing groups go in. I used to lead the bereavement group for hospice at adult daycare facility. And I remember every year that I was doing that, I would see a sign saying that part of Jazz and Classics, one of the groups from Jazz and Classics, and the daycare facility is for usually it's elders with dementia, and Jazz and Classics would come down and play. And, of course, school groups go to the Pioneer Home and they go to Wildflower Court. And this is just wonderful. So when you were at Wildflower Court, did many groups come in? Were there volunteers?
Yeah, a wide variety. Yeah, of volunteers. I mean, definitely that invitation of bringing the community more and more into Wildflower Court so that everyone who lived there felt part of the community.
Yes. Okay. And any thoughts you had? Now you're emeritus from Wildflower Court and from hospice, but is there anything you wish could happen in a place like Wildflower Court or like the Pioneer Home that would improve it for people who are living there? Is there anything that on your wish list?
Well, one thing that one of the other homes has, and I can't remember, and another part of Alaska, that I think would be wonderful because it helped a person who might not be able to get out of bed themselves or, might need assistance getting up where they might have to wait for staff to come and help. They had tracks up in the ceiling so that a person could, by remote control, have that track come down and hook themselves up to help them get up and get over to their wheelchair, and it just promoted more independence.
Oh.
And I remember seeing that thinking, wow, wouldn't that be great?
And you've hit upon something that people fear, which is dependence, not being able to get out and about. And that would be incredibly spirit lifting. Many people talk about what happens when an elder, let's say an elder without dementia, is, let's say, urged by their children to go to a retirement home or a continuous care facility, just like my in-laws went to, where they had their own one-bedroom apartment, but in the facility was care for people with dementia and rehab facilities, etc. But their meals in the dining room. Anyways, it has been said that sometimes people go downhill when they're put in a facility. Do you have any experience with, your patients or clients going downhill?
You're thinking of residents that might be moving into Wildflower Court?
Exactly. They're being urged by their family. Hey, mom, dad, you can't climb these stairs anymore. Mm-hmm. You need to go to we don't have a continuous care facility here.
We don't.
Okay. So that really is different. The only way you get into Pioneer Home or Wildflower Court is with a pretty serious diagnosis, I would imagine.
Well, the Pioneer Home is assisted living. And so with the Pioneer Home, you can, need just a bare minimum of assistance in order to qualify to get into the Pioneer Home. Whereas Wildflower Court is licensed as a skilled nursing facility, and you definitely have to have quite, much more, many more medical needs and maybe an unstable diagnosis and hands-on care, much more so than you might need at the Pioneer Home.
Okay, so you could be completely cogent, have no signs of dementia, but be frail and possibly qualify for the Pioneer Home. In Gawande's book, he talked about how sometimes elders will enter a facility like that mainly because their kids are exhausted, even if they aren't taking care of them on a regular basis. They're tired or exhausted from visiting and making sure mom and dad is okay. So I know you didn't work at the Pioneer Home, but does that make sense that for individuals who are going in not of their own choice, but because there's a lot of pressure on them to do so, it might cause depression or a decline in cognitive functioning?
Mm-hmm. Well, and definitely at the point that a person is coming in, potentially maybe to Wildflower Court, what I would do when people would call is, why don't you bring them in for a tour way before you're ever really talking about it? I mean, they might be calling around trying to get information to try to help the person decide for themselves, okay, I want to go.
Yeah.
Because really, it's pretty difficult in this day and age, unless a person has severe dementia, for a family member to be able to push them in or force them to do something that they don't want.
In the case of my own in-laws, from out of state, now deceased, it was really understandable. What happened is that they were in their early 90s and doing fine, but would their kids who lived in the area took it upon themselves to do a lot of lawn mowing and house cleaning and just checking in on them. And those kids really wanted mom and dad to be in a place where they were safe, safe.
Yeah.
And mom and dad were fighting it every inch of the way. And they were about 90 at the time. So there can be pressure, but you're correct. You can always say no.
Well, and I think it's difficult when children, of course, are very worried about their parents, one if both are living or one or the other. And they do have safety first and foremost, but that's where it comes back to asking, well, what does the parent want? And maybe the parent's willing to take the risk and potentially have a fall or have something go wrong at home. And I hear what you're saying where, parents can succumb to the pressure.
Yes.
Depending on the parents.
Yes. We're going to take a little break now. If you have just joined us, this is Mind Over Matter, and I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. In the studio with me tonight is Julie DeLong, a social worker who has worked with elderly and dying clients for over 30 years. So we're going to take a short break for a little light music and be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and the topic of tonight's show is aging and dying. I'm talking with Julie DeLong, a board member with the Foundation for the End of Life Care, and a longtime social worker in the field of aging and dying. So, Julie, let's take a look at a big topic that has really come of age recently, and that is excessive medical interventions for people who are very, very old or for people who are most likely terminal. Mm-hmm. And Atul Gawande, in his book Being Mortal, a book we've been referencing quite a bit this evening, really takes that issue on. And he's a surgeon and he's an ethicist teaching at Harvard. And the book Being Mortal came out last year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not the first one to talk about this. I think that even in conversations that I've had with friends, we have brought it up. And when you're filling out your medical directives, it's something to think about. What kind of heroic measures would you like to loan your body for experimentation? One thing I did notice in Gawande's book is he talked about how many procedures that people, out of fear, will fear of dying, will agree to. Often neither prolong life nor ease suffering.
Well, and I think in terms of him mentioning, when a physician is talking about an aggressive procedure, the patient is thinking, oh, maybe I'll get 10 or 20 years out of this. And the physician is really thinking, oh, hopefully I'll get them one or two more years out of this without that conversation happening. You know, it's mainly talking about the procedure.
It's, yeah, and not the side effects of the procedure. And this is really tricky for Junoites particularly because these high-tech interventions often occur down in Seattle or somewhere else in the United States where you're away from your community. They have to occur there. And how many people I've known of who have spent months in Seattle only to come home and die, or have died in Seattle. Mm-hmm. So obviously the treatment they were getting didn't work, or it didn't work well enough. And the last months of their lives disrupted family, and they themselves didn't have the support of the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might have prolonged their life, but where were they during that, you know, being prolonged? You know, you're right. They were in Seattle. They weren't here back in Juneau with family and friends and the support that they would get by being home.
And perhaps suffering from the effects of a cell transplant or chemotherapy or radiation. I'd like to read something that I took out of Gawande's book. He said, "The medicalization of mortality becomes most apparent at the very end of life, when the American health system spends billions of dollars on the medical equivalent of lottery tickets." And he's talking about aggressive and often futile interventions that may make patients miserable and apart from their loved ones. So he mentions that in 1945 in the U.S., most deaths took place in the home. By the 1980s, just 17% did. And I wonder what the statistics are for today. But imagine, in 1980, it was 17% of people died at home. Obviously, the rest of them, most of them died in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have, I would imagine, a much higher percentage of people dying or in long-term care with dementia because medical interventions keep them living longer.
No, well, you know, or individuals that don't have dementia.
Yes.
You know, just, I mean, you're right, in this day and age, boy, we've got the technology and medicine to keep bodies alive a long time.
Yeah. Well, what What are your feelings and reactions to what Gawande has written about heroic interventions?
Well, I appreciate his writing and, you know, being upfront about his own methods at the beginning as a surgeon and looking at a person as, okay, what can we fix here? What can I do to fix this for the person? And changing his ways from being, you know, very abrupt and, you know, giving his patients the facts. Let's see, I can cut this out. We can give you radiation for that. We can chemo for that. We can do this, that. He said he used to be very cut and dry, giving choices. I mean, that's what we all want, choices. But are those really the choices? And, you know, started.
As if all choices are equal. And I wonder if any of the choices are, or you could do nothing.
Right. Well, and that's where he started turning his views around. He started, you know, spending time with other physicians who were spending time with terminally ill and seeing how were their conversations with their patients going. And so I was very glad to see that he started talking more about what did the person want. You know, their goals were paramount to then determining what course of treatment he might make and being more person-oriented. I mean, instead of this is a patient, what medical intervention can I do? Because that's what a doctor's for. I'm here to fix it.
Well, I think he was talking too about even before the doctor gave all the choices and went into great scientific detail, medical detail about each option, that previously maybe a physician would just say, this is what you should do. So then there was the enlightenment of saying, well, these are the choices you have. But I think what Gawande is taking it one step further and talking about having a real conversation, not a lecture. And let me go over, if I can, what Gawande recommends that a physician do or ask. Number one, what is the patient's understanding of their health or condition? And this is very big because somebody could be either probably minimizing the lethality of what they have. So they want to get an understanding. The doctor should have an understanding. You know, I think these questions are even good for family members, really, to think.
Because often if it's not the patient that's in denial, it's the family member that's in denial.
But I'm thinking even for if I had an elderly parent who was in a situation where we had to make some choices about medical interventions, I think I'd want a direct question. What is your understanding of your medical condition? Because they may have an understanding that's very different and may be inaccurate or may be accurate than I do. And then what are the patient's goals if their health worsens? What's most important to them? For example, self-efficacy or autonomy could be very important to one person. Another person, I know when my mom was dying, she was reducing her pain medication so she could talk to me, but then at times the pain got too great. So her goal was to be able to converse with her family members. She wanted to be able to talk to us. And third, what are their fears? You know, what are they most afraid of? Being unconscious, being incapacitated, being in pain? What are they willing to tolerate? What are they not afraid of? And that really brings up the fourth question, which is what are the trade-offs they're willing to make and not willing to make? Wow. Quite a different discussion than simply a didactic one with the pros and cons. So do you think this model is do you think physicians and other healthcare workers are changing their model of how they deal with end-of-life issues? Have you noticed anything?
I think they're moving in that direction. You know, I mean, part of being able to have discussions like this it takes time. A person's going to have to, you know, put aside the time. It's obviously going to take more time than a 15-minute appointment or a half-an-hour appointment to have this back and forth, or maybe multiple appointments to have this conversation. It's a hard conversation. You know, I heard over and over, you know, who wants to be the bearer of bad news? Mm-hmm. You know, it's difficult for families to talk about, the patient and the physician. So the sooner it's talked about, the less power it has over, you know, incapacitating the person, or aids alleviating their fears about their prognosis, about their physical condition. And, you know, I was struck by one of Dr. Gawande's comments that he realized that by having this conversation, how much easier it became for him to provide treatment, because then he knew what the person wanted and what treatment was going to work towards that patient's goals. But it took him a while to get there, and I think that's where physicians are right now. They're working in that, working towards that direction.
And there's some specialists in palliative care. Is that correct? It's a specialty, mm-hmm. but as I recall, there are very few people who are very few physicians who choose that specialty. There are very few palliative care specialists around, and yeah. certainly not in Juneau.
Right. I don't know any personally. Well, other, you know, a couple up in Anchorage, you know, but
that's
not
right.
here in Juneau.
As the one who came to speak.
Yeah, but I do think that we have physicians here in Juneau that provide palliative care without being called a
yes.
palliative care specialist.
Yes, yes, yes. Is it? I thought I heard that Medicare is now providing a payment for physicians the time they spend talking about end of life issues.
It actually hasn't been voted on yet, to the best of my understanding.
Oh.
It was like the American Medical Association generally provides the codes for any kind of billing.
Mm-hmm.
For Medicare, and then it's mimicked by insurance companies. And the AMA presented codes to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid so that they could start billing. So that process started. It was submitted to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and I believe it's supposed to be discussed, voted on this fall sometime, and then hopefully go into effect 2016.
That's really what we need. And it's not just about saving dollars. Mm-hmm. It is about saving pain and suffering.
Well, and acknowledging the importance of the conversation.
Oh, yes, absolutely. If you have just joined us, I just want to mention that I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Julie DeLong, who is a social worker who has worked with the elderly and with dying clients for over 30 years. And I'm talking to Julie about her work at Wildflower Court with hospice and really looking at aging and end-of-life issues. So to wind up our show, I would like to take a look at the idea of a good death. And think about what does that mean? Julie, what do you think people want in a good death?
Oh, gosh, you know, so many things. You know, I think if a person is reaching the end of their life, you know, has the person, you know, reached some personal acceptance with that? Are they comfortable in as a person ages, or as a person comes to the end of their life, they're looking at their life review? You know, what have I done in my life? You know, where have I come? Has it been a good life? Am I ready to go? Is there unfinished business, bucket mm-hmm. list? Did they accomplish what they wanted to? Or, you know, did they make amends? Did they forgive others as well as themselves? So with that, you know, initially starting with acceptance, then you're, you know, looking at what does that mean? If a person is to be as prepared as they can, what would be very helpful in having a good death is having open and ongoing communication. Physicians, families, patients, so everyone knows where a person is.
And boy, I think a really important thing is that your children are not squabbling over your medical treatment, that it's mm-hmm. clear and there's harmony mm-hmm. in your family would mm-hmm. be much more important.
Exactly, which not just having it written down in your advance directive, talk about it. Be yeah. sure that your children know what your wishes are, separate from having it written on a piece of paper. Keeping the patient in control as long as possible.
And you know what that probably means to people? Dying at home. Mm-hmm. I think most people, I can't imagine anybody saying, I want to die in a hospital. Mm-hmm. They'd say, I want to die at home. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the data on how many people do die at home these days. Mm-hmm. It may be, there might be a slight curve up mm-hmm. just because of changing attitudes. And if hospice is available, mm-hmm. because you only do hospice in the home. Mm-hmm. Once somebody's in a hospital, they don't receive hospice care.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Well, true. The thing with, being able to receive hospice care at home, you know, it's trickier. You can have volunteers and nurses and social workers, maybe spiritual leaders come in, but you still need to have some kind of support for that 24-hour care.
Yeah.
And I think with family schedules, I mean, generally two people are working, maybe the adult children are working, maybe there aren't actually physically enough people to provide the extra support needed,
mm-hmm.
Which makes it harder for a person to die at home.
Right, absolutely. And I think one of the most important things that I've experienced in my own life, working with my own clients, and also as a hospice volunteer and leading the bereavement group, is life meaning. And not only is having a meaningful life important throughout one's lifespan, but it's particularly important when you're aging, because by that time, your children have left the nest if you've had children. Grandchildren may be far away. And your career has ended, probably. And for many of us, our lives were pretty much consumed by raising kids and working. And then suddenly, right at the time of your life, when you maybe need it most, those two aspects of meaning disappear. And so what I've witnessed is that people who have meaning in some way, it could be artistic meaning, they could be a writer, they could be an artist. It could be community service. It could be engaged in anything that they have a passion for. It's really having a passion for something. And I see that with my elderly clients and with the widows and widowers that participated in my bereavement support group at hospice, those that had the most vibrant lives, they were really needed, and they made themselves needed. And that includes, like I said, the arts. Okay. Ironically, or almost paradoxically, it's easier to let go. It's just like what Jimmy Carter was saying.
Mm-hmm.
What he was saying is, I've had a good life.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to praise himself, I'm sure. But we know he's had an incredible, meaningful life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So on that note, Julie, I want to thank you for sharing your rich knowledge about aging and the dying process. And I want to thank John over here, bicyclist extraordinaire, traveler, and technological wizard, for contributing to running the board on tonight's show. And thanks to our listeners. Don't forget to join us next month on another Monday night at 7 p.m. on K200. Good night.
You're listening to KTOO FM in Juneau.